We love the applause for the boss. Barb was in Detroit, and what you may also know is that Melinda Haig, who's seated in the front row, was the U.S. attorney here in San Francisco. Woo! Melinda. So I should finish telling you a little bit about Barb. You know that she's a law professor at the University of Michigan School of Law. She also, like me, is an analyst, a legal analyst for NBC and MSNBC. And she's, despite all of her commitments, written this book. And it's appropriate that we're here, by the way, on Super Tuesday Eve. This is a great book to talk about tonight, Attack from Within. It tells us a lot about who we are as Americans right now and also about the challenges that we're going to face in the coming election. So you ready to dig right in?
Let's go.
Your background at the Justice Department before you became a U.S. attorney was in national security. And you had a pretty deep background in national security, and that came in very handy on your first day after being notified that you'd been confirmed by the Senate to be a United States attorney. You want to tell us about it?
Oh, I suppose so. So I had been an assistant U.S. attorney for most of my career and was lucky enough to be nominated by President Obama to serve as U.S. attorney in Detroit, the Eastern District of Michigan. And I got a call on Christmas Eve of 2009 that I had been confirmed by the Senate. You know, when you become a U.S. attorney, you get confirmed by the Senate. And the only reason the Senate had stayed that late was to pass the Affordable Care Act. Remember that, when that was a big deal? So I think it went something like this. They spent all day on the Affordable Care Act, finally passed it, and then they said, oh, and then all those other people have been nominated for positions. Yeah, them too. And so we got in. And I thought, this is so great. I'm going to have the best Christmas ever. I'm going to kick back and have a wonderful time with my family before starting this important job. And then the next day, Christmas morning, started seeing my BlackBerry rattling around. Remember those things, BlackBerries? Started rattling around, and I looked at it, and it was a notification from the FBI that an Al-Qaeda operative had tried to blow up a plane over Detroit with a bomb concealed in his underwear. So he became known as the underwear bomber, but the bomb malfunctioned, and fortunately no one was hurt. We prosecuted him and he was convicted. But that was my first day on the job, and I realized that this is not going to be a sleepy job. We were going to be on call all the time, and we were.
So your national security background, I think, influences the book, at least as I read it. Can you talk about that and why you wanted to write the book?
Yeah, I mean, I see disinformation as a threat to our national security. I think it's a threat to our democracy. It's a threat to public safety. It's a threat to the rule of law. But when it comes to national security, it is affecting our standing in the world. So as a national security prosecutor, as an assistant U.S. attorney, you know, I've seen the threat evolve. It was Al-Qaeda, and then it was ISIS, and then it was cyber intrusions, and then it was Russia. And now it is really domestic attacks with disinformation. Just today, I saw that there were AI-generated images of Donald Trump posing with various groups of African-American people to make it look like he's got all of these supporters in the African-American community. But if you look closely, you'll see that some of them have three fingers or six fingers or something, which is a bit of a tell that they're generated. But as I say in the book, what the world saw on January 6th was evidence that they are using to say that democracy doesn't work. And this is why we're seeing democratic backsliding all around the world. See, it's a failed experiment. People don't accept the outcome of an election. People engage in violence when you have democracy. And after all, democracy isn't the point, is it? It's prosperity. And we can all be more prosperous if we just go along with the strong leader. And so in Russia, there were people after January 6th who were toasting champagne and saying the United States is limping with both feet. And so they are holding us up now, not as the model for democracy, but for the model of how democracy doesn't work. And since World War II, it has been the national security policy of the United States to try to promote democracy around the world, like, you know, the NATO alliance and other things, because democracy leads to stability worldwide. It means there are fewer wars. It means we have more trade partners. It means there are fewer refugee crises. And we're seeing all of those things coming to roost because of the fragility of democracy around the world. And so we have lost some of our moral authority to lead because of the attacks we are seeing through disinformation on our democracy.
So I like that framing as a national security issue. And to talk about the book, I think we need to start by defining terms. You talk about disinformation and misinformation. Do you want to distinguish for us?
Yeah, and you know, maybe people have different definitions of these things, but as I define them in the book, disinformation is the deliberate use of lies to deceive and manipulate people. That's disinformation. Misinformation is kind of its unwitting cousin. So people may hear disinformation, believe it to be true, and spread it without realizing what they're saying is false. I'll give you an example because all of us really can very easily fall prey to misinformation. I once did it myself. In fact, sometimes my kids tease me and refer to me as misinformation. What would you do without children, Joyce, right? They keep you humble. But here's a story about myself as a purveyor of misinformation. There was a time when I read online that the breaker of all dreams, Patrick Mahomes, is it too soon to talk about him? I read online that Patrick Mahomes had said he would not play another down for the Kansas City Chiefs until they changed their name to a name that was not offensive to Native Americans. All right, that's pretty big news. And I thought that was a big story, and I retweeted that right away. I got to get that out because people rely on me, Joyce, to tell them the breaking news. They can't read it elsewhere. They count on me. So I had that obligation to fire that off as quickly as possible, which I did. And then a few hours later, I'm with my husband and my son, and I said, did you guys see that story about Patrick Mahomes? Can you believe it? And they said, no, I didn't see any story at all. What do you mean? What? How could you not see that? It's big news. And they said, no, are you sure it's true? And I said, well, it must be true because I read it on Twitter. So I started thinking about it and thought, I better see what the source of that was. So I went back and I looked through it like, oh, there it is. And it's ESPN. That's very legitimate. And it says Sprotts Center. So it was not genuine. It was not ESPN Sports Center. It was a fake with a deliberate misspelling. So I immediately took down my own tweet. But it was just a great example, I thought, of how easy it is to be duped by disinformation, you know, kind of just get sucked into it.
Yeah. So that makes sense. And it's helpful, I think, to have that as a baseline to understand the difference, because not everybody who's involved with the spread of misinformation as opposed to disinformation is a malicious actor, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I think right now there are two basic categories of people who are spreading falsehoods online or in the real world. Those who fall for it, you know, there are people who believe that the election was stolen because they hear it again and again, or they believe that COVID vaccines don't work because they hear it again and again. You know, I think these are people of good faith who have been manipulated by disinformation. But I also think there are others, and these are the people who know better, and yet they engage in disinformation anyway, because it is in their best financial interest or their political interest or their personal interest. I mean, tell me that Senator Ted Cruz or Senator Josh Hawley really believed that the election was stolen when they voted against certification on January 6th. I mean, my gosh, they know better. Or tell me that Elise Stefanik, when she refers to defendants who have been charged and are jailed for their conduct on January 6th, refers to them as hostages. I mean, they know better. And so this is the group that I think is so insidious and is so harmful. They are who I refer to on Attack from Within. You know, this photo image on the cover is supposed to be a right fist bursting through a map of the United States, because that is the attack coming from within. People who know better and yet are going along with lies because they believe it to be in their political interest. They are choosing tribe over truth. And I think that is what we cannot do. If we are going to be a country, you know, by the people, of the people, for the people, we have to agree to truth, even when it doesn't advance our own particular agenda. You know, as lawyers, we know that to have credibility, we have to concede points from time to time. And that's really important. So anyway, I think there's a problem with those of us who are duped by misinformation, but a bigger problem with those who deliberately engage in disinformation.
So talk to me about the thesis of the book. I mean, everybody has not had a chance, and please feel free to liberally applaud for Barb throughout it.
And
I will stop talking when you do.
But let's not make this like the State of the Union, you know, how you got to applaud after every line, and then half the room is like, no, I'm not applauding. Not that. Not me. Nope. So we don't need to do that.
Right. Thursday night, something to look forward to later this week. But talk to us about the central thesis of the book and the points you're trying to express.
Yeah, you know, I think there are really two points, which is, one, you know, propaganda has been around forever, for centuries. But what has made it so challenging for us today is technology, because it is now possible to spread a lie at the press of a button and to reach millions of people. And so it is really pervasive. And the second is, we are living in particularly polarized times. And it is because people have learned that the way to gain political followers is to stir up excitement, stir up emotion, prey on fear, manipulate people to suggest that there are only two sides to any issue and the other side is the demon. And so you can't possibly favor that side, so you must favor my side and come over here. And that there are only, you know, two choices in the world. There's them and there's us. And if they are such an untenable choice, then you must side with us. And ultimately, this idea that there's no such thing as truth at all, that truth is for suckers, truth is for the naive, and that what really matters in this world is getting what you can when you can. Everybody's corrupt anyway, and so if everybody's corrupt, you might as well choose the person whose values you share or vision you share or is going to be best for your own personal self-interest.
Did you feel like you were talking about the book 1984 when you were writing this?
Many times. In fact, I quote 1984 a little bit. Yeah, I read it in high school and it was a book about the future. But yes, right? I mean, there are moments when I really feel like, is this something, is this real? Is this really happening? You hear politicians say things that, like, you know, up is down and down is up. And you just can't believe that people buy into this and agree with it. You know, the idea that the FBI planted evidence at Mar-a-Lago, but Donald Trump actually retained them because he had the right to do that. Well, which is it, right? And this is a play right out of the Putin playbook, which is, there are conflicting versions of the facts all the time, and it doesn't matter, because what matters is whose side you're on. And so someone could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and not lose any voters, because it's about supporting the person, the identity, and not ideas or issues. And that is a really, I think, dangerous place to be.
So what do we do about it?
I have some solutions that I propose in the book. I won't go through all of them, but I think I could divide them maybe into two broad categories. There are those that we can solve together with our government, and then there are things that we can do ourselves, I think, to prevent and protect ourselves against disinformation. So at the governmental level, there is a famous Supreme Court case you may have heard of called Citizens United. Right? You know this one? This was a case,
I've heard about it a time or two.
You heard about this one. Citizens United was a case about 10 years ago that the Supreme Court decided that corporations, organizations, and labor unions have First Amendment free speech rights, and that the First Amendment does not permit any restrictions on their spending in support of candidates for office, as long as they don't coordinate with the candidate themselves. So it has opened the doors to dark money in campaign finance. You know, there are, you know, millions and millions of dollars that get funneled in, and they're political super PACs, and they might have names like the Red, White, and Blue Grandmothers of America, when in fact it's Russia or an individual special interest person. And there's no way to know it. So one solution would be, you know, we can't change that without a complete reversal by the Supreme Court. That's not going to happen. But we could require transparency in campaign finance laws. So let's just peel back the curtain and tell us, disclose who is, you know, behind these super PACs making these donations. So I think that would be one way. I think we need to do some more regulation on social media. Sorry, Silicon Valley. I know who butters your bread out there. And it's okay. I'm not suggesting we go so far as to repeal Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. I know you all know, because you live here in the heart of it all, that is the statute passed in 1996 that said that social media platforms are immune from legal liability for the content that's posted on their platforms. You know, they just provide the platforms and other people come in and provide the content. And you know, in 1996, that sounded pretty good. They sometimes refer to the words in that statute as the 26 words that created the internet, because it did foster innovation and people felt free to, you know, create these platforms. But here we are now, 28 years later? I don't do math.
Yeah, I never do math in public.
Yeah, all right. So a long time ago, and things have changed, right? Sometimes you read the statute, it talks about social media offers a wonderful world to connect with others and share. You know, it sounds like a children's storybook. It's like, you know, raising a baby alligator in your bathtub. It's adorable when it's a baby, but then, you know, 28 years later, it has grown into a man-eating predator. And we need different rules for different times, I think. So I'm not suggesting we remove all of the immunity, but I do think there are things we could do that might be a little more subtle that would help reduce some of the disinformation. So for one, you may have read this Facebook whistleblower named Frances Haugen, who testified before Congress. And she said, it's not so much the content, it's the algorithms that are on social media that push us toward content to generate outrage. Because if we're outraged, we're more likely to stay online longer. You know, I got a real zinger for that guy. Look what this person said. I'll top you. I'll show you. I'll say something, you know, snarky, and we'll pass it on. The more we're online, the more eyeballs look at it, the more advertisers are seen, and the more money the platforms make. And so that is what is generating a lot of the outrage that is online. And so maybe we could require disclosure of these algorithms so that if we're being manipulated, at least we know that. You know, they say if the product is free, then you are the product. And I think we are largely on social media, we are the product. The other way in which we are the product is that they build these incredible portfolios on all of us where they know everything about us. You know, you go online and they suggest like, it looks like you would like to buy these new boots. And I look like, why, yes, I would. How do they know? they know me so well. And they do know us so well because they know all of our preferences. Every time you take one of those little surveys, they're banking it all. And so it allows them to micro-target groups and send you a message that is so tailored just for you that they know it will appeal to you. So, you know, are you a left-handed LGBTQ member who loves the San Francisco 49ers? Well, let me send an ad to you. And so again, I'm not suggesting that they stop doing this, but maybe just disclose how they're doing this so that we know when we are being manipulated. So those are a few ideas for the government side, which is, of course, all of us. But I also think there are things we can do as individuals to help us build resilience against disinformation. One is media literacy. You know, in Finland, where they have been victimized by Russian disinformation for decades, they have introduced media literacy into their schools, and kids have learned how to read newspapers with a skeptical eye. And, you know, some tips for all of you. I'm sure you're a smart crowd. You probably already know all this. But did you know that the headline often doesn't match the story? You ever notice that? I've noticed that. The headlines are, you know, they're kind of clickbait. I once had a chance to visit the newsroom of my local newspaper. And they toured me around. And I saw like a big board, you know, like a screen like they have at the airport where all the departures are the arrivals. But this one had the top 10 stories of the day and how many clicks had been generated by that. And the top of the list were all about pets, celebrities, the weather, right? That's what we click on. We really are the country we deserve, aren't we? That's what we're clicking on. And then, you know, way down here is maybe like the state budget, which is probably the most important story there. But the message being sent to the reporters is, you know, generate clicks, write stories that, and the headlines are also designed to generate clicks. So when you read a headline, of course, before you pass it on and say, Patrick Mahomes will not play another down until they change their name, you know, you should actually read the story and see what it says. It might say, Patrick Mahomes won't play another down until Chiefs say their name, is something Mahomes did not say today, right? So you might want to actually read the story. As I learned, it might be a good idea to check for a second source. If this, you know, big story really happened, chances are more than ESPN Sprott Center would be running it. Probably find it elsewhere. So that's a good tip as well. If there is a study or something, really important to look at the sample size, right? Was it 3 million in the sample size or was it 3? That could make a difference. The difference between correlation and causation. You know, you might read a study that says something like, studies say that children who eat dinner with their parents are more likely to graduate from high school. And so you say, oh, well, there it is, causation. So as long as we have dinner with our kids every night, they're going to graduate from high school. But of course, that's probably not the only factor, right? They have a roof over their head. They probably have, if they're having dinner with their parents, they also have, you know, a stable family life. They have food security. So they have a lot of other good factors going on in their lives that is probably contributing to these good outcomes. So being a skeptical reader is really important to avoid falling for disinformation. But I also think there's one more thing we can do, which is that we make sure that we are choosing truth over tribe. It's very tempting, I think, to always want to root for your side and to always say that's not true because that goes against my interest. I mean, today we had this decision from the Supreme Court about the 14th Amendment. I know a lot of people are saying, oh, the court's in the bag for Donald Trump and, you know, he should have been removed from the ballot. I'm not so sure. I think it's actually a reasonable interpretation of the 14th Amendment. And I think that there are a lot of people who are so upset about Donald Trump and want with every fiber of their being to see him removed from that ballot and never hold office again. That they want a certain outcome and therefore they will believe that a certain outcome is the only right outcome. And I think that, you know, as we said, sometimes you have to concede points when you're, if you're going to be credible, if you're going to, you know, follow the truth and make that, you know, your purpose, then I think you have to concede points. And so it's incumbent on all of us to be responsible with the truth, to not engage in snark online, to not, you know, dunk on people just because you can. And so I think that's really important that we not pile on and tear down our institutions when they don't favor our desired outcome.
You know, do you think, like me, you've got four kids and you teach at the graduate level, the law school level. Do you think that the younger generation is better at siphoning out disinformation and misinformation?
I do.
Is there cause for optimism?
I do. Actually, I think they are very, very savvy. Actually, one reason that I have optimism, Joyce, and I cite this in the book, is something you wrote about in Substack, which was there was a study of people who watched regular watchers of Fox News when they unplugged from Fox News and consumed media from other sources and then took a survey at the end of that period. They had changed their opinions on things. And so it does demonstrate that people can have flexible minds if they are exposed to other sources of information. So I think that's a really important thing too, is to make sure we get out of our echo chambers and listen to news from, read news from lots of different sources. But young people give me great hope. These young people are idealistic. They are disturbed by some of the things they're seeing in the world, but they are highly motivated and they want to make the world a better place. And I get to spend every day with these people. And I will tell you, it gives me hope.
You know, me too. I mean, it really does. I agree with that 100%. I am interested in an experience you had this week online, on Twitter, when you yourself became sort of a victim of disinformation. Barb had made what I thought was an absolutely accurate assessment of a point of law. And she made it online and was then just attacked from all sides. Do you want to talk about it and talk about how we can all handle those situations, which I think increasingly happen to all of us, either in daily life or online?
So, you know, there's this immunity issue that has now gone up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will be deciding whether Donald Trump is immune from prosecution in the federal election interference case. And the race is on a little bit as to whether they will decide the case quickly enough so that it can come to trial before the election. And the point I made was a simple one and an accurate one, which is remember that the right to a speedy trial belongs not just to the defendant, but also to the public. And that is based on case law, the Sixth Amendment, federal statute, lots of things. And I got bombarded with all kinds of things saying, you liar, it's not true. You call yourself a law professor. You say you were a prosecutor. And it really seems very coordinated. It went on and on and on. So I decided to write a little thread thinking like, oh, you know, these people are just miseducated. They just don't understand. Allow me to enlighten them. So I wrote a very earnest little thread and said,
it was earnest.
It was earnest.
It was so sweet.
It was not snarky at all.
No.
It was not mean. And I laid it out. You know, here's this case, Barker versus Wingo, and all of the reasons, right? It would, if it were not the case, it would allow the defendant to manipulate the system. Delay can be to the defendant's advantage. A victim's rights are not vindicated by delay. The person could commit other crimes while they're waiting. Evidence can go stale. Witnesses' memories can fade. Like, there are a lot of reasons. And so the Supreme Court has held in a case called Barker versus Wingo that the right to a speedy trial belongs not only to the defendant, but also to the public. So, you know, 10 little tweets in my thread, and there you go. You're welcome, world. I have now educated you. And do you know that all the same people came back and just said the same, you liar, you call yourself a prosecutor, you liar, liar. So there are some of those who don't want to be educated.
My favorite was the guy who said, I don't want to have a right to a speedy trial. Do you remember? Did you see that? Some guy was like, I'm a member of the public and I don't want it.
Yeah. He's waived the, yeah. For the
he
whole public.
He waived it for all
public.
Of us.
All right.
I mean, it never ceases to amaze, right? So something that we have not talked about yet. We've talked about Barb's book a lot. We talked about it on our podcast, hashtag sisters-in-law. We've talked about it on and off during the writing. But I teach in the area of democratic institutions. I know you've talked about the impact of disinformation on the rule of law and democratic institutions, and I'm interested in your thoughts in that regard.
Yes. So I believe that disinformation is harming our democracy. You know, I talked about the national security aspect, but in terms of just voting rights and the ability for all of us to cast a ballot, after the 2020 election, which was Donald Trump's own cybersecurity director said, the most accurate and safest in history, 61 out of 62 lawsuits ruled against Donald Trump. The sole victory was a procedural issue unrelated to the outcome of the election. Every audit concluded that Joe Biden won that election. And yet, we see in several states, new voting laws passed to make it harder to cheat, to commit fraud. And so I believe that fraud is being used as a pretext to make it harder for people to vote. Brian Kemp, the governor of Georgia, who defended that election and was a strong leader defending that election against Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the results there, nonetheless signed this law making it harder to vote in Georgia and said, that's to prevent fraud. Even though there is no, so it's a pretext. And the reason it's so problematic is it has a disparate impact on people of color, students, people who are of lower socioeconomic wealth, because it is more difficult for them to get to the polls. Less early voting, more voting only on election day, less places to deposit your ballots, longer lines in polling places, and even forbidding people to provide food or water while people are waiting in long lines to vote. I mean, what is that all about? You know, because they want to encourage them to go home. Don't wait, don't cast your vote. So I think that, you know, in all the gerrymandering that we see, you know, designed to create these crazy shape voting districts to try to squeeze out candidates and, you know, favor certain groups over other groups, all of that is really harmful to democracy. In Michigan, we had a great program called Voters Not Politicians. The idea is voters should choose their candidates, not politicians. And so a law was passed to create an independent commission to decide what the boundaries are. And it's made up of a group of Democrats, a group of Republicans, and a group of independents. And they redrew all of the congressional and state legislative lines. And after they did that, the next election, for the first time in 40 years, the state of Michigan elected a Democratic House and Senate. And as a result, have seen all kinds of new laws passed. So I think when we use accurate information, we allow voters to take back their power. And when we use disinformation, you know, we need these laws because there's voter fraud. And so we have to have these laws to make it harder for people to cheat. Well, if nobody's really cheating anyway, what's the real reason we're doing it? And I think it is to suppress votes from people. You know, if you can't win a vote through hearts and minds, you can win a vote by suppressing the vote of your opponent.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California radio program featuring a discussion between Barbara McQuaid and Joyce Vance about disinformation. I'm Gloria Duffy. Please stay in touch with the Commonwealth Club, our events, our travel program, and more by subscribing to our email newsletter at commonwealthclub.org/email. Now back to our program.
Are you worried about the effect disinformation will have on this election?
I am. And I don't know that it'll be what we've seen in the past, although it may be. But I do worry about some of these scams designed to fool voters about some of these new laws. So, you know, there are new laws in a lot of states about voting. So it might be difficult for people to know those things. And it may make them more susceptible to falsehoods. So, you know, for example, you may have read that in New Hampshire during their primary, there were AI-generated robocalls with a voice that sounded just like Joe Biden, you know, talking about malarkey and everything, saying you should stay home, don't vote in the New Hampshire primary. And so people got these robocalls and they sounded pretty good. They sounded real. In fact, they were generated by artificial intelligence. And so I worry that we're going to see more and more of that. You know, you can imagine seeing a video of someone online that looks incredibly valuable, either giving you false information about voting or saying something awful, you know, looking like Joe Biden or someone else, saying something incredibly offensive that people will believe to be true. I worry about that. In the last election, there were cases. In fact, there was a conviction for men who generated a texting scheme where they targeted African-American communities and sent out text messages saying, did you know you can vote by text? It will be very, make it convenient. No need to leave your own home. Just text if you want, you know, to vote for this candidate, text this number. To vote for the other candidate, vote this number. And many, many people wasted their vote by sending in a text to that. So I worry about those kinds of things. And I also worry about, you know, we had the violence that we saw on January 6th. I'm sure this